Okay, this is Frank Hymans interviewing Clarice and Rob Johnson for the Department of Housing's Millers Point Oral History Project. Today's the 6th of October 2005, and this interview is being conducted at Narromburn, New South Wales. This is state number MPFH31, side A. So, now I'll start with you, Clarice, if that's all right. Clarice, can you first tell me your full name?
Clarice May Johnston.
Is that with a T?
Yes.
Okay. And when were you born, Clarice?
On the 4th of August,
1923. Right. Ooh, good. Yeah, right. You look pretty good for your age.
Thank you.
Where were you born? Which place?
I was born in Gulgong, New South Wales.
Right. Yes. And you grew up there as well?
I grew up around the Dunedoo area, a little bit north of Gulgong. And I came to Sydney when I was 17, just the beginning of the war.
Now, before we get to Sydney, can we talk a bit about growing up in Dunedoo? Tell me a little bit first about your parents. What kind of people were your parents, would you say?
I don't know, it was just a funny little country town and went to school there.
Yes, and your mother and father?
Yeah, my father in the earlier days was farmer, and then he became a plumber in town. We moved into the township, and that was when I left home and came to Sydney.
Right. Okay. So, which schools did you attend? And where?
I went to Leadville School, and it was quite a thriving little place in those days. I'm afraid it's dwindled down to almost nothing now, but it was a lovely place to grow up, and yes, it was very. I found the heat. It was very hot. And I kind of dodged the heat and came to Sydney.
All right. What kind of community was it down there? Were there many farmers?
It was a very active community. You know, we had all kinds of games. Like we played a lot of tennis, and that was about. You know, about all, a lot of riding, and but apart from that, it was very quiet.
Right, nice country town.
Yes. Oh. Small country town.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I'm the eldest of five children, and my sister was 6 years younger than me, and my brother. Another 2 years, then I had another sister and another brother. So there were five of us all together. Right. Unfortunately, my two sisters have passed away, and just me and my two brothers now.
Right. What about your mum? What did she do? Did she look after the house, or did she have a
job? Oh, yes. She did a lot of gardening and grew all our own vegetables and fruit too, for that matter, fruit trees. And she lived till a few days, 3 weeks before 90, and she passed away then. But she was, even though she was a diabetic for many years, she was a very healthy lady. Grew all, as I say, all her own vegetables, and she always said that kept her. Her healthy and helped her with her diabetic thing.
Right. Mm. She sounds like she was a pretty tough lady.
She was indeed.
Okay.
Wonderful mother. We learned so much from her, and I'm still learning from her. Things I think now, what would Mum do in a case like that? And she always comes to the rescue.
You really ask her, do you?
Yes.
That's lovely. You get a bit of divine guidance.
I can always feel her presence.
Right, great. So how long ago did she die?
She died in 94. Yeah, 94 she died.
Right. So, Robert, you have good memories of her as well, do you?
Very vivid memories. She was, as Mum said, a wonderful lady, very much an influence on all our lives, I think. She had an amazing patience with all of us. She was a wonderful person. We all miss her dearly, there's no doubt about it. Right. The strength of the family.
What about your father? When did he die, actually, Clarence?
He died in 76.
Right. You would have been a fairly young man then, Robert.
Yes, from memory, I was about 22, 23. Hmm. And another version of my grandmother, though, I think, a very strong person, very influential in virtually everybody around him. He was a very strict man, but a very fair man.
Did he serve in the war?
No. No. He had I don't know what it was. It was a bone disease in his leg. And he had many operations when he was younger. And he was never able to serve in the war at all. So,
they were in the First World War.
Yes.
Right, okay. Now, you left Gulgong at 16 to come to Sydney. So that would have been late 30s, right? 1939?
That's right, yes. Early 1940.
Early 1940. Just the war was on then in Sydney.
Yes, it was more or less in full swing then. You know, people were going.
What do you remember about the war years, Clarice? Do you have any memories?
Well, I lived in Harbord, the other side, and met my husband shortly after I came to Sydney, and we kept company for a couple of years, and he joined the army. And then before he went to the Solomon Islands, we were married. And he was away until 1946. But I stayed with friends, and I went to work in a photographer studio the time that my husband was away. And that was... it was a happy time, you know. We made our own entertainment, and, yes, it wasn't... I missed him terribly, and that was sad, you know, but everyone was in the same position, so...
Right, well, you just got married too, didn't you?
Yes, that's right.
You must have been worried about him, though.
Oh, yes, every day was a worry. You know, listening to news broadcasts and waiting for letters and all that kind of thing. But, as I say, everyone was in the same boat. But he came back in 1946, and Robert was born middle of 1947.
Right. So, did he tell you much about his wartime experiences, your husband? What happened to in the Solomon?
He was in the tank battalion, and he spent a little time in New Guinea, but most of it was in Bougainville on the Solomon Islands. And he was there after the Japanese surrender. He was there for about 6 months or so of the cleaning up, mopping up period. So he really wasn't, in the later part, he wasn't in a real danger zone. It was just unpleasant then having to stay in the war zone when everyone was coming home at that stage. And yes.
Right. Now, I know that you weren't born yet at that time, Robert, but do you have any tales you can tell me that your father might have told you about his wartime experiences?
The first one that just came to mind, and it wasn't really Dad's story, it was Mum's, when the midget submarines came into the harbour.
Yes.
I think you were on a ferry or about to get on a ferry at that stage.
Come home from... We had been in the city, and this was just before my husband went away, and we'd been on the ferry back to Manly, and we wondered why all the lights were out. And even though they had blackouts, you know, and we had to keep the everything covered, he was in the wardens. He had to do help and make sure that everyone was safe in certain areas they had. So he left me at Manly in the wharf there. And he went off, and I had to get a bus to go to Harbord, where we lived. And that was quite scary. It wasn't until afterwards that we realised it was that the Japanese submarine had come in, and that was what everyone was, you know, yes.
You think that was the night that they sank the Catapult, that ship, the ferry?
Mm.
Would it have been that evening?
Yes. Yes. Yes, well.
Because they sank one ferry.
That's right. It was quite an eventful, yes. An eventful evening.
1942, I think it was.
Yes, it would have been. It would have been. Yes, I can't think of the date now. Can't remember.
Going back more than 60 years.
To answer your question, Frank, Dad never spoke a great deal about the war and what have you. He was. I think he sort of came back, and that was part of history, and he sort of didn't block it off at all. It wasn't a psychological thing of not talking about it. It was just something that he never went back on a great deal. But he and I, and my younger brother as well, always went to Anzac marches, and we regularly did the dawn service and the like. But I think I'm right in saying that what I remember, and I must have been, I guess, 3 or 4, of Dad still suffering from malaria of some description.
Yes.
And I can remember him still coming out in sweats and delirium and what have you. It was still part of what I grew up with in my very, very early years.
So many years later, after the war, he had malaria, in effect.
Yep.
Right, yeah. They were amazing, those men. They sacrificed so much, didn't they?
Well, we came to Sydney then. We left Harbord shortly after he came back from the war. And that was when we first came to Millers Point to live. And that was where Robert was born then.
So tell me a little bit about the house that you lived in at Millers Point when you settled there in 1946, when your husband came back. Where was the house?
That was in Gloucester Street. And we went to live with friends who had the house, and they had more space than they really required. And they gave us kind of a helping hand until we got settled. And then the Maritime had accommodation that they put us into in Merriman Street.
Little Essex Street.
Little Essex Street first. Yes.
So you started off in Gloucester Street?
Yes, in Gloucester Street, and then moved to Little Essex Street.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the number in Gloucester Street?
I can't. It had a couple of nines in it. I think it was... No, I can't.
It's all right. What about in Little Essex Street? What number was it there?
Yeah, that was number 2.
Number 2.
Yeah, right on the corner of Gloucester Street and Little Essex Street.
So how long were you in the first place in Gloucester Street?
About 2 years. We were there for about almost a year before Robert was born.
So Robert was born.
And then we moved to Little Essex Street. And that was where I had another son there.
Right.
And he would have been 18 months old, and we were absolutely delighted when the Maritime Service Board had a house available in Merriman Street.
Right. So 2 years in Gloucester Street?
Yes.
And how long in Little Essex?
Probably about the same.
Not the same, yeah. So that was your first experience in living in Millers Point?
Yes.
Right. So how did you take to it? I mean, how did you find it?
It was strange because most people were wharf labourers, very, very, almost everyone. You really weren't accepted unless you were a wharf on the wharves. And that was very hard, but we fitted in. But it was a number of years before, probably 4 or 5 years before we were accepted in the community as such. Everyone was kind to us, but you weren't taken in as close friends or anything. It was a very tight-knit community.
Right.
But I quite liked it.
Yeah. Okay. So, the house in Merriman Street, what number Merriman Street was it?
That we were in the 11.
11 Merriman.
11, and it was a block of 6 flats.
And which ones did you occupy?
We had the we had 11. They were known as
11A.
11A.
11A. The ground floor was 11 and 11A, and then it went up.
And then
9 and 7.
9 7, yes.
Right. One block of 6 flats.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that still there, that building?
No, that was demolished in 1972. And the observation tower was built where that block of flats were.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful block of flats. It was constructed from an old building, and it was the last construction put up when the war started. So it was really only built in the late 40s. Sorry, the late 30s.
Right.
And then they found that even after they pulled it down and built the observation tower, it wasn't really what they wanted anyway. So we were all then housed in different parts in Millers Point. Everyone sent into Windmill Street and High Street and we were very sad, very unhappy about that.
Right. Now, Robert, you grew up in that house in Durand, 11A Merriman Street.
Correct.
Can you sort of take me for a walk through the house, what it was like, the layout of it, so that you remember it?
Yes, as Mum said, there were a three-storey block of flats, so you had the same blocks on the left and the right. The entrance was in the middle with a staircase that obviously went up to the other units. Ours was on the left-hand side as you walked in. Letterboxes on the left-hand side of the wall. All the letterboxes were there under the stairs. You went in through the lounge room door. It was a very pleasant-sized lounge room, very unusual for that end of Millers Point at that stage. Quite large room. Most of the places, as Mum said, were a lot older than this. On the right-hand side, as you walked through the lounge room, was the door into the room. Again, a nice size room, 3 metres by 3 metres, I guess. It was quite a large room. It had an adjoining kitchen to the right-hand side again, which was very serviceable. Everything was, I was going to say, very new, but Dad and a couple of the neighbours put the benches together and what have you. That all had to be rebuilt, but at that stage the Maritime were very slow in doing maintenance work. So a lot of the work was done by the local people and the residents. Back door was at the kitchen. There was a kitchen window above the sink. naturally. So they always built the same way. Coming back into the lounge room again, if you walk directly past the dining room door and into a small room which served as a junction, I guess, for two bedrooms, one on the left, which was Mum and Dad's, one on the right, which was my brother's and mine, and a bathroom directly in front of you. Toilet, shower, bath, everything all in the one room.
Did you have, what kind of stove did you have? Was it a fuel stove or was it an electric stove?
Gas,
sorry.
Yeah.
So you were pretty well off compared to some of the places I've heard about.
Oh, yes, certainly. It was, as Mum said, built in the late 30s, so it was all fairly modern as far as that's concerned. We still had an ice box. The ice man still came around and delivered ice in a Hessian bag, but we resolved that after a couple of years, I suppose. We had the ice box for a little while.
Right, yeah, well, that was pretty common, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes, nothing unusual.
So apart from the Iceman, were there some other men that came and delivered things to you, Clarice, do you remember?
No, I don't have much recollection of... I think there were about three guys worked together, you know, and they delivered the ice. But the worst part was if you ever forgot to empty the ice tray.
I remember the rabbit man. I remember the rabbit man coming around selling fresh rabbits. He used to annoy the life out of the dog that we had. He had a particularly high-pitched call when he was coming, and the dog used to go berserk. And the milkman was the other thing, that Mr. Lawrence and Scotty. And that was a thing that people nowadays raise an eyebrow and what have you. The milk was delivered in bulk, of course, so there was just a... The milkman arrived with a dipper in his hand, and we had our billy can hanging at the front door, and that was filled up, and we had fresh milk every day.
Right.
So those regular sort of things were good.
Yeah, excellent. So they don't do it anymore.
No.
No more rabbit man either. I don't think anyone ever eats rabbits now, do they?
I don't think so. Certainly not from the back of a utility, I can promise.
Our greengrocers were just delivered the same way. We had a fruit and veggie man and his...
Wally Jackson.
Truck, yes.
Jacko.
I've heard about Jacko, yeah. Other people have spoken about him.
The famous, famous character. He lived in Kent Street, just off Kent Street there.
Mm.
Worked on the Harbour Bridge as a lane changer. But he was a... He was a character.
Oh, so in his spare time he used to deliver the veggies?
It was only Saturdays. Yes. Saturdays, I think.
Mostly only once a week, I think. Mm. I can't remember more frequently. But he was very good. He'd get his supply from the markets and then deliver it around, and you could just go out and shop from the back of his truck. It was good.
I think we were towards the end of his run, so if there was a box of bananas left, you could buy a box of bananas for 2 shillings. I mean, you'd throw most of them away. I think it just occupied our bin instead of his, but it was another 2 bob for him and got rid of the rubbish.
Easy on the way home, less load.
Exactly.
I used to make a lot of jam and things, you know, and if he'd find something at the markets that he thought I could use, he would bring it. He used to get the... melons, the pie melons, we used to call them. You make jam out of them. And he knew they were not easy to come by. And he'd come in and say, I've got 3 melons, do you want them? You know, and it was always exciting, come jam time. I wish I could find some now.
Did you do a lot of preserving of food, like something that you used to do in the old
days? Not a lot, no. It wasn't economically right. I did in the country, and my mother did the pantry was always full of preserved fruit. But to buy the fruit and the sugar and everything, it wasn't economical. So. But the jams I did, you know.
It was interesting just to link the country connection and Jacko and the vegetables, what have you, that... Summertime particularly, Grandma and Grandad would send us down on the train a box of the summer fruits and what have you. So we'd go up in the on the Saturday morning. I've forgotten how they got home. I'm not sure now, but a box would arrive, a beautiful banana box full of fresh apricots and things directly off
the They delivered the it from from the train. My dad would put them on the train and they'd come to Sydney and they would be delivered.
All sorts of wondrous things in there.
Right. So there was a bit of a support system going between the country and the city too, was there?
Oh, yes. Well, there must have been because otherwise we wouldn't have been able to have got them so quickly. But we didn't appreciate... Well, we appreciated it, but we didn't examine why or how it happened.
No, but I think it was very much a personal thing, that it was the direct family thing that nobody else, to my knowledge... I mean, I'd take some of this fruit to school and things, and the kids were just gobsmacked that this had arrived and we had all this fresh fruit.
Yeah.
So it was very much a personal thing. But it was one of those things that we were a very close family, so it was a natural thing for my grandparents to do, the grapes and all sorts of things that were would arrive.
Right. Now, tell me a little bit about the shops in the area that you used to buy your stuff from.
At Miller's Point.
At Miller's Point. And who were the shopkeepers? What were their names and what did they sell?
It was very, very good. There was a little grocer's shop on the corner of Bettington and Dalgetty around Merriman Street and Bettington Street. There was a lady had a little shop there. Don't think of her name.
Brennan.
Mrs. Brennan.
Brennan. Brennan's.
And she had everything. And it was not like a supermarket now where you went in and chose what you wanted. You'd just go to the counter and point out what you wanted. And because we only lived at the end of the street, shopping was never a problem. She kept everything. And as I said, the rabbit man would bring the fresh rabbits and we'd have a rabbit most every week. And the butcher shop was on the opposite corner. It had been there for years and years and years.
Was it Duggan's or Grubbs? Which butcher shop?
No, Duggan's. It was...
Oh, was it Duggan's? What was it called?
It was Duggan's originally.
It was the Garrison Butchery.
Yes.
Which has recently closed. But who were the... I've forgotten the names of the people that...
Yeah, the Duggan's. Remember Grace Duggan's daddy? You went to school with one of the children.
Jed. Yeah.
Jed.
Okay, yeah, I forgot my connection.
Well, that was all the one family. Yes, they, I think they lived in
Windmill Street.
But they ran the. That was my first knowledge of the butcher shop. But it was the oldest one, the oldest butcher shop in the district. Yeah.
Just take a break for a second. It's the end of tape number MPFH31, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH31, side B. Right, the butcher, okay, we've got the butcher there. Was there a fish shop around the place? No?
Yes.
You remember one, Robert?
Kent Street, yes, just in Kent Street, just around the corner from Argyle and Kent. It's now a fish shop again. It's a cafe, but when I went to primary school, it was a place where every Monday we were given ninepence for our lunch because Monday the bread was stale, so we'd come down from primary school and buy our lunch. So the fish shop was there, yeah.
Right. And where did you get your hair cut?
Mr. Lewis, next to the butcher.
That was Rube Lewis, wasn't it?
Rube Lewis, that's correct.
Yes, I've heard about him.
He was the book exchange man as well, who my grandfather, when he came down from Dunedoo, used to bring a suitcase full of Zane Grey westerns and things and swap with old Rube. He'd spend half a day, I think, up there going through the books that Rube had to swap, and he'd take them back to Dunedoo. So Rube's books got a long way around.
What was he like as a character? Was he one of the... local characters of the neighbourhood?
Yeah, he was a character, really, because he was a little bit unusual. I think Jewish, probably. I don't know that, but looking back, it would be, I guess, nobody knew or cared, I don't think. But a short, grey hair around the edges, balding.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about it.
Bronzed skin. He was, yeah, quite a character. Unusual as well.
In which way?
Unusual in as far as there was nobody else in the area that looked like him, acted like him. He always had his nose to the ground. I think if there was a dime to be made somewhere, he'd find it. But a character, yeah. A nice guy.
Okay.
And cheap haircuts.
Yeah, how much did you pay for a haircut?
I can remember how much we used to pay for a loaf of bread, and that was ninepence. My brother and I used to call in on the way from school to pick up the bread every second day, I think, from Brennan's little shop, and it was ninepence a loaf, and she had it ready every day, wrapped up in a little piece of tissue. Nice.
It was difficult for quite a long time before food became... that you didn't have to have a coupon for, you know. And we had to have coupons for bread and milk and... not milk, meat and butter and cheese. And I need to go.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
That's all right. Would you like a glass of water?
Thank you, Kat.
I don't remember the coupons. The coupons.
The war coupons, that's war. Yeah. The coupons goes back to the 40s, the early 40s.
Yeah.
But they stayed a long, you know, quite a long time before we could really shop for, particularly for butter and sugar and tea and things like that to bring there. But eventually we came.
Right. See, not many people can go back that far in coupon days.
Before my time. Stayed at the shops?
Yeah, you were still in the shops. What other shops were there that you might recall?
There was opposite the Argyle Park, there was a little milk bar, I guess, and sort of general store, but that was Conran's, which was an interesting little shop because it was... you'd have to duck your head almost and take a step down into Conran's. Had an old wooden floor. The joinery and things were quite ancient, but it was a lovely area of oldie worldy things that was always a pleasure to go in.
It was.
There was no opposition to him as far as the milk bar was concerned until Greg's. The Greeks moved in on the on the other corner, and that was, I can't give you a year, it must have been, I don't know, 55 or something thereabouts, but this milk bar all of a sudden opened up with chrome and glass everywhere and all sorts of funny things. And it put poor old Mr. Conran, I think, not quite out of business, but his business halved, that all the kids at that stage, of course, went to this modern Greek milk bar.
Yes, it was a lively corner. Meeting place, yeah. Too, for the young people then.
Milkshakes and things they used to
drink?
Yes,
yeah.
And it was a much more lively corner, being on the corner of Argyle Place and Kent Street, whereas Conran's was over in Argyle Place itself on the other side of the park and tucked away downstairs and dark and fairly dismal and what have you.
But it wasn't as much fun. It was more the place where the parents went to shop and the younger people, you know, went to the milk bar. And we had a very good chemist there too. And I think he saved many a parent a trip to the doctor or the hospital.
I've got stitches. Not stitches.
He was wonderful how he put people together.
Quite a long scar on my index finger on my right hand, which is probably 30 to 35 mil long, But no stitches. It had been bound it all up and kept it together and saved a trip to the hospital.
Talking about hospitals, there was an eye hospital, wasn't there, at the end of Merriman Street. Does anyone have
that
any experience?
That was before our time. That was a long, yes, a long time.
Wasn't there anymore when you came?
No.
No, it was, that particular area was always referred to as the Aussie hospital. You know,
the eye Aussie. When we were there, there was a quite a large playing area. It was half the size of a football field. And there was a stevedoring place just beyond that. But the park, the council park, was always referred to as the eye Aussie. And that came from the eye hospital. But never saw the building.
No, it had gone before you came?
Yes.
Right. Okay, it must have moved up towards where it was later at Sir John Young Crescent, maybe.
Yes, somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I don't know when it moved, but it certainly wasn't a building.
No, it was.
Was there a doctor? Did you visit the doctor?
No, there was no doctor in the area. Actually, we went to Glebe. To the doctor. There was no local doctor.
Dr. Hill?
There was a doctor in Kent Street. Dr. Hill was, I think, in Kent Street.
But he wasn't there very long, I don't think. Glebe Point Road was the...
Yes.
Was almost the local doctor.
Mm. Now, Rob, what sort of memories do you have of childhood memories of you have of growing up in Millers Point? What sort of games did you play? Where did you do it and so on?
My earliest memories go back to Little Essex Street when I was about 2 and a half when we moved out of Little Essex Street. And I went to kindergarten at Lance Kindergarten from there. Well, I actually now have very vague recollections, but it's still there, of my first day at kindergarten. Pardon me, when we had a long hallway near the front door and then going down the stairs to the footpath sort of area. And I remember pacing up and down, being quite impatient to go to kindergarten. Some of the best years of my life, I think. And when we moved out of there, I think it was Mum's brother Kevin and my father helped us move, and I have still a recollection of my three-wheeler dinky being manoeuvred over the veranda on the second floor,
yeah.
And being lowered down on a pulley and rope and what have you, quite symbolically, I'm sure, but to me, watching from the footpath, it was the most important thing that had happened to me. Moving around to Millers Point, to Merriman Street, it was a new experience. I remember vaguely going there the first night, and I don't think there were any lights on. We had a key, but we hadn't moved in. We had a quick look around and what have you. There were kids my own age next door, which was something a little different. The neighbours that we had previously were a little older than I was. Life was good. We had a great big backyard out the back. Exhausted from running up and down, we'd pitch a tent in the backyard and sleep outside overnight, play cricket out there. We had badminton nets up and all sorts of things as we grew up. The playground, the eye Aussie, was another great source of activity. Play cricket and football and goodness knows what down there. We had
it
a dog.
It was a great place for
it was
to,
terrific.
To bring the kids up. It was really...
You couldn't ask for much more in a suburb of Sydney now, let alone in the middle of Sydney, was quite extraordinary. I didn't see anything else around the area that was as good as where we were. We had gardens, vegetables, you name it was all there.
I had lots of pets.
White rabbits, guinea pigs, turtles, dogs, cats.
Birds.
Everything. All at once. So it was a terrific childhood.
Clarice, what sort of support system was it for the mothers? What did they do when they finished their day's work and so on? Did they get together at all?
Not a lot, no. All of us who lived in the block of flats, you know, we were very good friends and did lots of things together. And then when the boys joined the kinder, went to kindergarten, we had a mother's club, the kindergarten. And that was really good. It was a great support system then. And we had to raise money, you know, they weren't subsidised very much at all. And we used to do all kinds of things to raise some money. We'd have euchre nights and housey nights and anything else we could we could think of. And because we did have such a big area, a big living room, and we used to put lots of tables and chairs up and we'd have lots of people come. And we enjoyed the company. Yes, we used to work quite hard for both the kindergarten and the school. Then when the boys went to school, that the parents and citizens played a big part. And eventually they, I think it was probably when they went to high school that my husband then became vice president of the Australian PNC Association.
Oh, your husband was vice president, yeah.
So, yes, it was...
on a federal level.
Wow. What did he actually do for work, your husband? What was he engaged in?
He did all clerical work, but he worked for different companies. He worked for an oil company. It doesn't exist anymore. It was Purple Oil Company.
He became part of Ampol, I think, from...
I was trying to think whether it was part, but he had they eventually, you know, dead. But finally, he was working with a Travelodge motel.
Right.
And that was his.
Now, Robert or Claris, can you tell me what evidence there was that this was a maritime precinct? I mean, tell me what you remember about that activity on the wharves there.
About the
activity on the wharves, the ships coming in. What sort of things would happen?
Lots of things happened.
It was part of everyday life. I mean, you'd wake to the ship's whistles of a morning, and you'd go to sleep with the drunk seamen wandering up and down the streets of a night time. It was just part of life. Everything I think that happened around Miller's Point happened around or had something to do with the maritime. The neighbours all worked for the maritime, as I say, the ship's whistles. Alongside the block of units, the flats where we were, was a Dalgetty wool store. That also went when the demolition happened for the observation tower. Now, those trucks would run from 7 o'clock in the morning until 6 or 7 o'clock of a night time. They were connected with the waterfront, that they were bringing wool in from the railway stations to the wool store as a central depot. There was a chute then that went down to the bulk shipping down below. So that was all just part of life. The smell of diesel was, ship's diesel was just part of life.
There were, when the ships would come in, you'd have to watch which way the wind was blowing, whether you hung your washing on the line or not. And that was our biggest worry.
It would be covered with soot, would it?
Sometimes you put your washing out and about midday you'd bring it in and start all over again. Absolutely black with the soot from the ships that came in. Very active, a lot of activity then.
And a new ship in at any of the wharves and the local pubs, the Palisade and the Lord Nelson and the Captain Cook, any of them, all of them were all full of new sailors and goodness knows what. There'd be fights and God only knows what. So as I say, it was just...
It's all part of the entertainment.
It was just part of everyday life.
And you liked that kind of thing? I mean, was it enjoyable, that kind of activity, to see it, to watch it?
It was... I think it was like living anywhere else. It was just
an acceptance.
It was just part of life. It wasn't a problem. It wasn't...
No, there was never a... You could never say it created a problem. No, I mean, not as far as we were concerned. There were some very colourful characters about, but there was never... It was all harmless.
What kind of colourful characters would there have been?
Oh.
Can you remember anyone?
Lots of...
particular?
Drinking and lots of fighting amongst themselves too.
We had some local characters across the road in Merriman Street that the Bergen boys and the Pearson boys were quite notorious around the area. Very keen to mix it with anybody that cared to mix it. There were a few unsavoury characters around too. Some famous, infamous names, I guess. Danny Chubb and people like that. That were around, but they never caused the locals any problem. There was never any problems with the locals. They all got on all right.
Did you feel safe, though, living in Millersport?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Very safe.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes. There's not a person. We used to go on holidays we'd all go back to my family for holidays, and we wouldn't lock the houses up. I never locked our window up, because we used to leave it open for the cats to come in and out, and the neighbours would feed them. But if the cats wanted to come in, they came in through the kitchen window. It would never occur to us to lock our houses up.
It was the safest place in the world. I think as I went through into high school and what have you, I played basketball at Coronation Playground up near Central Station, and I'd come home aged 16, 17, from Wynyard or Circular Quay. I'd get a train back, and I'd walk back up through Miller's Point and not blink an eyelid, not be concerned about anything at all.
Yeah, I've heard of a few murders that have happened at Miller's Point.
Sure.
You know of any?
Only one that I'm aware of, and that was there were two. Danny Chubb was shot to death in High Street, but then there was what did they call him? There was a special name for a serial killer. As I was going through primary school, and one of the boys that I went to school with, Johnny Greenfield's uncle, was murdered at the stairs in Argyle Place. And the serial killer had a trademark that he cut the penises off the men that he killed. And this was, I think John's uncle was number two or number three. There was one in the Domain or something. So, they were fairly unusual things. But I can only think of the two. I'd forgotten about one.
Yeah, Danny Chubb was...
Danny was a gangster.
He was shot right in front of his mother. On the steps of the halfway down High Street.
Oh, that's not nice for his mum especially.
No, she was a lady.
She was a lovely lady, yes.
Well, he was a bit of a character, huh?
But you used to have, we're just talking about safety and things, mum worked several jobs at a time just to see my brother and I through school. And one of those was a cleaning job in Martin Place.
Yes.
And there was one of the local characters, I've forgotten his name, that used to walk you to and from parts of Mum's walk back just to make sure that Mum was okay, but he was just
of no fixed abode, but, he was... A nice enough guy, and yes.
And another character was Elsie. Was it Elsie that slept in the old laundry?
Burke was her name. What was it, Elsie?
It was Elsie. I've forgotten.
Can't remember. No, she was a funny lady. She wasn't very old either. She was quite young, but she. She would sleep on anyone's doorstep out of the wind, you know.
Elsie?
Is it Elsie? I'm not sure.
No, her name wasn't Elsie. Her surname was Burke.
There was a character called B. Miles that used to be around the area, did you know?
She wasn't not around
there. Not around Miller's Point. She was more the rocks and the place in the area. We didn't strike. Well, I didn't strike. Right there. I remember seeing
Do you remember... No, you can't remember. Ethel Burke.
Ethel.
It's amazing what you can do when you're thinking.
Yeah. She frightened. She was the only time I've ever been frightened. She really scared me that night. I went out to the laundry.
The laundry was a detached part of the building. It was the old kitchen, if you like, cookhouse from the original building where the flats were built. So it was a separate part of the building.
And there were three sets of tubs and coppers, you know, and they were gas coppers, and you had to boil the water. No washing machines or anything like that. And it was a damp day. I had hung the boys' clothing in the old laundry. We had lines across. And it was fairly late at night. I thought I'd better go out and make sure their clothes are dry for school, you know. So about 10:30, 11 o'clock, I went out to the laundry. And I was sort of walking around with my head in the air, feeling the clothing on the line. And all of a sudden I became conscious that something had moved at my feet. When I looked down, it was Ethel. She had made herself a bed in the middle of the laundry. And I almost put my foot on her. And she was just moving away from me because she didn't want to frighten me. She was a nice enough person, you know. And I'll never forget, I wanted to scream at the top of my voice, but I knew I would upset her if I did. But that, I went inside and of course the family said, "What on earth's the matter with you?" I was white as a ghost.
So she was a sort of itinerant that used to make a home anywhere?
Yes. Eventually, she went to the country. I think she went to Orange. And she was fruit picking, and she developed pneumonia, and I heard that she died up there. But she would have been only in her late 30s or 40 then. And I think she had some kind of breakdown, and because she had a family earlier on, you know, she did have people, but she just broke away from the normal way of living, and that was what she did. We did have a few colourful characters there, but they were all good.
Was the health of the people, the general population, was it good generally in Millers Point? Were people healthy?
Oh, yes. I think so.
Yeah, I don't think there was any great problems. There's a degree of alcoholism around the place, I guess, but if a health problem or a social problem, I don't know. But I think generally there was the standard of living was quite good.
The worst part, I think, as far as the standard of living, if you could call it that, was when they changed the times at the hotels, when they changed it from 6 o'clock closing to 10 o'clock closing. Up until then, the wharf labourers and the really guys who worked really hard would come in and drink as much as they could until the 6 o'clock closing came. Well, the idea was close at six, leave the hotels open, and they could go home and have their meal and come back, but the trouble was they would forget to go home and they would stay until 10 o'clock closing, and that caused a domestic problem. And so many of the women kind of thought, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us too. So they would go down to the hotel then and join their husbands. And a lot of the children were left alone until 10 o'clock.
Which is not good for kids, young kids, to leave them alone like that.
And that was the worst period until, I think it probably took a year or more before they became adjusted.
The novelty wore off, I think.
Well, pubs must have been the place where a lot of meetings were held too, were they? Were they sort of a social support system, the pubs?
Oh, They were held more in the homes, in people's homes, the support they didn't have.
What function did the pubs have altogether, would you say?
I really don't know, because we didn't associate with
it. It was really just a drinking hole, I think, but I guess it probably served a networking process for the local people. I mean, you'd congregate there, the locals would congregate there for whatever reason, but it was only gossip and a few beers, I think. I mean, they didn't have the things that RSL clubs and what have you have nowadays. There were no, to my memory, no fishing clubs, no dart clubs and what have you. There might have been the odd sort of situation like that, but it wasn't a social function other than bringing some people together. But it was just a matter of an excuse to somewhere to drink, I think.
Yes, I can't. I'm not aware of any actual social activity.
Anyway, you don't look like a pub person at all.
I don't know.
Dad used to call him for a couple of drinks, a couple of beers on his way home, and that was just to catch up with a couple of friends about the day. And then
relaxation time, but fortunately, the drinking was never our problem.
How did the Millers Point people consider the Rocks people? Did they consider them as part of their territory, or were they separate?
That was quite something. No, the Millers Point started in Lower Fort Street, around anything George Street side was the Rocks, but they were very adamant that don't get us mixed up, and you didn't refer to people in the Rocks area as Millers Point. And nobody in the Millers Point area wanted to be referred to as Rocks people. They would be close friends, that was all right, but just don't... There was that distinction, you know. And for mailing or getting... organising anything... If you were organising it for the Rocks area, okay, that was the boundary. Organising something for Millers Point, well, you were on the Millers Point area. But that boundary was very, very strict.
That's the end of tape number MPFH 31, side B.